Summer 1986, 30 years ago, I lived near Croydon. That's where I grew up, and I've been into Croydon. I bought a couple of records, and the album that I bought was a copy of Fables of the Reconstruction by R.E.M. Uh-huh. I was walking back to my house down our long, very leafy suburban road. It was a really hot day, and in the distance, no one around, in the distance, there's a man walking towards me, dressed in black leather. I was thinking, that's what an idiot out of this weather. And I get close, I thought, blimey, that bloke looks like Joe Strummer, right, in our road. And he gets in, it's Joe Strummer. I think, oh my God, it's Joe Strummer in the street. I can't just pretend. What am I going to say? What am I going to say? And as he went past, I went, all right, Joe. And he went, all right, mate.
That was it.
That was it. And history was made. I don't know why he was there.
Surely you didn't go, what are you doing?
No, I should have done. Now I would.
In suburban Croydon.
Come and have a cup of tea with my mum. No, I missed my chance.
Man, that's a belter.
Yeah. Hello and welcome to Backlisted. Today we're gathered in the library of our sponsors Unbound, the publishers who bring authors and readers together to create great things to read. I'm John Mitchinson, runner-up of Corduroy Wearer of the Year 1987. Corduroy, King of Cloths, Cloth of Kings.
Hello everyone, I'm Andy Miller. I'm the author of The Year of Reading Dangerously, and also, I don't normally say this, but there's a reason for doing so, I'm also the author of the book in the 33 and a third series of books about albums, of a book about the Kinks, at the Village Green Preservation Society.
What an amazing coincidence.
There's a reason why I mention that. Why is that? Guest John Niven.
Well, yeah, I am guest John Niven, author of novels like Kill Your Friends, and also a novel called Music from Big Pink, which was my first novel in 2005. Four or five, which was published in the same series as Andy's book. Yeah, yeah. So we are label mates.
We are label mates, yeah.
Yeah, I should say this is our guest today is John Niven, who is here to talk about The Information by Martin Amis. John, of course, known as a novelist. How many novels now? Six?
Seven
novels. Damn. The latest being The Sunshine Cruise Company.
And we're also joined, as usual, by the author and fundraiser, Matthew Clayton. Hello, Matthew.
Hello, everyone.
We'll be talking about Martin Amis, as I said, later, but I have to start, as always, with the question of all questions. Andy, what haven't you been reading this week?
What haven't I been reading this week? Yeah, I've been reading a book of short stories by the British writer Elizabeth Taylor, a book called The Devastating Boys. And I'm going to say a little bit about that, but I'm not going to say loads about it because I'm hoping we're going to do Elizabeth Taylor on a future episode of the podcast. But this was a book of short stories that was published, I think, in the early 1970s. And I read one of Elizabeth Taylor's novels before, Angel. I just thought this was the most brilliant collection of short stories that I've read since Tigers Are Better Looking by Jean Rhys. There's a story in there called, an amazing story called In and Out of the Houses, which is about 10 pages long, where a little girl during her school holidays goes from house to house in her village, inadvertently carrying the most terrible gossip between each house.
And like sort of virus.
Yeah, yeah, in the course of the summer. And in the course of the summer, the village falls apart and turns in on itself. Oh, it's so beautiful.
What a great idea.
And there's a really horrible story called The Flypaper, which is like something from Tales of the Unexpected. And there's another, and there's an amazing story called The Excursion to the Source. It's almost a novella. And it's a perfect collection of short stories because it has that thing. Every story is different, and yet each has a clear voice. They're all clearly written by the same author. And I've also just been reading, in comparison, The Devastating Boys. Oh, what a band name that was.
Good title.
But I've also been reading a volume of John Cheever's short stories called The Brigadier and the Golf Widow, and I like the Elizabeth Taylor more. I mean, the Cheever stories are obviously brilliant.
That's a big claim.
The thing with Cheever is it strikes me you have to buy into the voice. They're all written in a particular register, right? And as a result, some are better than others and some are quite samey.
Tortured gay wasp register.
So it's fine. Yeah. You know, plenty of bourbon and surnames.
Yeah.
but the Elizabeth Taylor just
That's a great memoir title, Bourbon and Surnames.
Don't you think, though, that short stories are a bit like sherry? Every few years, people suggest that they're about to become really popular again.
What, reinvent?
And they're not, you know, because they're not that good.
Agree.
I don't really like short stories.
I suggested a collection of short stories once to my publisher, and the reaction, I mean, you'd have think I'd laid a log on the table.
Yeah. So, I've also
noticed.
I did actually. Yeah. I wrote
so
a few.
Do you have a publisher for your short fiction?
You said
short fiction. I've spoken like a publisher. Never call them short stories. Short fiction.
Maybe we should talk.
Funny you should mention that. I think short story is a sort of. We ought to have a better word for what they are because, I mean,
nobody says I've just published a long story.
Yeah, you know what I mean. It's like story is the stuff.
But I also what I noticed with short stories, right? This is a thing that we do here on this podcast that we should try not to do. So if you say you're reading a novel by somebody and it's the first novel that you've read of theirs, like I was reading Angel by Elizabeth Taylor, and while I was reading it, I tweeted, I said, I'm really enjoying this book. Someone will inevitably say to you, you really should read the short stories. Right, they do that. So that I was reading the short stories, and while I was in the short stories, I was saying, oh, these short stories are great. Somebody tweeted me saying, you should read the letters. Right? So you get to the letters, and you go, we did this with Nancy Mitford, right? She said, you read the letters. But have you read the journals? It's like a series of Russian dolls.
This is a very
right?
Amisian kind of thing, isn't it? That great thing in information where he's talking about all the different streets, you know, how they kind of go down until you get to close.
That's right. But nobody ever goes, if I'd read Angel, no one ever would have the strength of character to say, you're reading Angel, you've done it.
That's it.
that's our best book and the essence of her work.
This
right?
is all you need to read.
Yeah. So, John, what have you been reading?
I've been reading... I feel it's a bit of a cheat because it's so much fun. It's a book called Daily Rituals by Mason Curry, who's a young American writer. But he's just done that, a really, really simple thing, but totally delicious. How great minds make time, find inspiration and get to work. Every literary festival you've ever been to, this is all anyone wants to know. So, you know, it's either... Do you write with a typewriter or a word processor or a pen? But also, describe your working day.
Yeah.
And, of course, it is endlessly fascinating. And this book is just, and it's not just writers, it's painters, it's musicians, it's everybody. Wow. I mean, there are some in here. I thought I might just read one because we're going to do one of the forthcoming podcasts, Henry Green, the novelist. But this has got to be the best working routine I have ever heard, bar none. He was managing director of a company called Pontifex. Okay. And it says Green's reliance on the stability of a day job was no doubt helped by the fact that his actual duties were practically zero. According to his biographer, Jeremy Tregown, a typical day in the life of Henry York, managing director of Pontifex, looks something like this. He arrived at work at about 10 a.m, was brought his gin, and spent an hour or two pottering around his office or gossiping with the secretaries. At 11:30, he left to spend the middle part of the working day at a nearby pub, refreshing himself with a couple of pints of beer before returning to gin. A colleague or two would eventually join him there, and then they would talk about people at work or the bar regulars, whose conversation Green would have been eavesdropping on while he was alone. When the managing director finally returned to his office, he repeated his morning routine and then, maybe, wrote a page or two of his novel before catching the bus home.
Our mutual friend Tom Hodgkinson once went to interview Bruce Robinson. He was trying to fix up a date for him, and he rang up Bruce and said, how about next Tuesday? And Bruce said, I'll look in my diary. Sorry, Tom, I've had a look, and it says, Tuesday afternoon, bottle of red wine and a wank.
We were talking about J.G. Ballard last time, weren't we? Ballard's routine was, because as you know, Ballard brought up the children on his own.
On his own, yeah.
So he would get the children ready for school, he would run them to the school, he'd come back, he'd pour himself an enormous whiskey, he'd drink the whiskey for 20 minutes, and then he'd write. I really understand
Ballard
had a huge scotch on the hour, every hour. That was
routine.
And he was actually asked in an interview when he said, he said it got to a point he thought, I'm not going to start drinking till 6 o'clock. And the interviewer asked him, well, was it hard putting that off? And he said, hard? It was like Stalingrad. trying to not drink till 6 p.m. After being used to hitting the bottle. So.
What's your routine, John?
Sadly, it doesn't involve any reliance on booze like that. It's really boring. I can only really write fiction in the morning, and the earlier the better. you know, if I can get the desk at 6:30, 7 a.m, that's fantastic. But more usually it's like 8:30, 9, and then done by lunchtime, really. But yeah, I've got so much stuff on the screenwriting just now that my partner Nick comes out in the afternoons and we work on whatever script we're working on in the afternoon, and then into the day deal with the emails and whatnot. But really, sort of 9 till 1 is kind of novel writing.
I'm exactly the same. The earlier I can get to the desk, the happier I am, so that I can be done by lunchtime. You know?
If you feel you somehow get 1,000 words before breakfast, you've kind of mugged the day. Everything after that is gravy.
I mean, I used to be able to do the long through the night stuff. I just fall asleep now. I end up in a pool of saliva on the desk.
I also think that's some, you know,
it's very
some bullshit, isn't it? That kind of look. That almost feels to me like, look at me, fag hanging out the mouth, tapping on the typewriter.
I think it can work when you're young. But Paul Schrader, who wrote Taxi Driver famously, said he would sit up all night out his mind on coke and whiskey. Cocaine, that is, not cocoa. And he'd write till 5 in the morning till he collapsed. And he said then he would revise sober the next day. And he said out of the 12 or 14 pages he'd written, he might get two that were good. But he said that sort of regime only works for a young man someday in their 20s. Because as you get into your 40s, say, you really have to have an incredible amount of stamina to want to live that lifestyle of abuse, you know.
Yeah. So this book... Routines, is it
daily
ritual? Sorry, is it interviews or is it
no? It's just a cut and paste job, but it's just getting a lot of these stories, some of which are unintentionally like that one hilarious, some of which are actually quite useful. I mean, it does honestly, having read it, the thing is getting up early does seem to be the, the consistent. I mean, there's a great one where Agatha Christie says, everybody says, when do you ever write? And she's great. She just said, well, I don't really know. I write in different rooms, but if I'm doing something, I just go like a dog with a bone and just disappear off and gnaw at it until I'm finished. And there's a great, obviously, Kingsley Amis, you know, which is punctuated again by whiskey. But I thought maybe I should say, do you want to hear what Martin Amis's daily routine is?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, okay. I've really got to resist doing my Amis impersonation just in case.
We should all.
And he basically said he doesn't have any squeamishness about writing. He told the Paris Review, Amis says he writes every weekday, driving himself to an office less than a mile from his London apartment. He keeps business hours, but generally writes only for a small portion of the time. Everyone assumes I'm a systematic, nose to the grindstone kind of person, he said. But to me, it seems like a part-time job, really, in that writing from 11 to 1 continuously is a very good day's work. 11 to 1, okay? 11, 12, 1. That's 2 hours.
2 hours, yeah.
Then you can read or play tennis or snooker, all very germane to what we're discussing next.
Yeah.
2 hours. I think most writers would be very happy with 2 hours of concentrated work.
But he's not wrong. No. I mean, I'll often sit, the longest stretch I'll sit writing fiction for will be 4 or 5 hours. But, you know, of those 4 or 5, it's probably really 2 is the way it all happens,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Who's that book by?
It's Mason Carey. It's published by Picador in the UK. Oh, but it's kind of, it's fun. It's really good fun. And actually, some of the painters are almost more interesting than the writers. I found it most diverting, and I'm sure it'll reappear in future podcasts.
Now it's commercials. So the novel that our guest, John Niven, was keen that we, I think in all cases, revisit. Have we all read it before?
Yeah.
Yeah. Was The Information by Martin Amis. John, can you say a bit about why? I know you're a big Amis fan.
Yeah. Well, as is known, I'm a huge fan. And this book, it's the last part of what's kind of viewed as his West London trilogy, if you will, with Money in 1984, then London Fields in 1989, and this was published, The Information, in 1995. So, and to my mind, as the years go by, it's actually the best book of the three. Although I think Money and London Fields get enormous plaudits, and rightly so. I think it's partly that it was a novel born in quite, you know, as is well known, difficult circumstances. He got a huge advance to, at the time, I think you'd remember better than I do, $500,000?
$500,000, yeah.
It's $500,000 for two.
20 years ago, it was fair chat. And he famous had dental problems and he got his teeth fixed and it was a long gestation process.
He left his
wife, of course. And it was a very tumultuous period in his life. And I read the novel when it came out because I was already a fan, but I guess I was only about 25, 26 myself then. And I loved it. I thought it was very very funny. But you know, books are like that. They're not inert things. They change for you over the years, like wine. As you age, your relationship to them completely changes. And to read it now in middle age, in my late 40s, is a completely different experience.
Well, we were saying earlier, weren't we? I was saying I read this when it came out when I was like 27. Reading it in 2016, I've got 20 years more experience of both the book industry and myself.
Yes.
both of which have made me feel a bit bleaker about it. So
it is harsh, isn't it? It is so harsh.
As we know, it's a novel really about literary envy.
Well, actually, I'm going to stop you there. We have a tradition on Backlisted of reading out the blurb. Sometimes it does.
Normally we would
also spend a bit of time giving you a potted biography of Martin Amis, but I don't believe anyone listening to this
it's the old joke on Martin Amis, my struggle.
Maybe, my mum might be sort of, who is this fellow?
So, okay, this is the
original first edition.
Flap copy from the original first edition.
95. Controversially published by HarperCollins. He had been a Jonathan Cape author previously for all his books, and this was the story. He moved agents, went to Andrew Wiley, and then Wiley did the auction, Cape lost, he went to HarperCollins.
And so here's the book which they launched as a bestseller. This is the description they gave to the public. Here we go. There aren't many ways for one writer to hurt another. Even if the literary world were as hopelessly corrupt as some people like to think it is, a writer cannot seriously damage a rival. This is the unwelcome conclusion reached by Richard Tull, failed novelist, when he contemplates the agonising success of his best friend and worst enemy, Gwyn Barry. A scathing review, a scurrilous profile, such things might hurt Gwyn Barry, but they wouldn't hurt him. So Richard Tull is obliged to look elsewhere, to the weapons of the outside world, seductions and succubi, hoaxes, mind games, frame-ups, sabotage, until at last Richard finds what he's looking for, a true professional, someone who hurts people in exchange for cash. That's actually quite good,
isn't
it?
It's a very good blurb, I think.
It's quite good, but straight after, there's a kind of final paragraph where it says, in the information, Martin Amis returns to the big picture of Money in London Fields. And I think within that one sentence, you can sense the publisher's fear that it's not going to sell.
I agree.
I think that one sentence within that, you can read between the lines, incredible fear.
There's also this really peculiar sentence following that says, the book takes in the whole of society, with the possible exception of the middle classes. all of society is part from one third.
That's a very odd sentence.
It is an odd sentence.
It's something he said himself, didn't he, that his father's fiction dealt almost exclusively with the middle classes, whereas his tended to deal with people from the gutter or the upper classes, the kind of two worlds he inhabits. But the blurb doesn't... It's such a fabulously funny novel. You know, Richard's... As he says that, he's a failed novelist. He's I love the sentence where he works as a sort of book reviewer. He's forever lugging some thousand page Robert Southey gentleman.
They're all late 18th century, sort of the works of Thomas Tusser, really mostly forgotten, mediocre writers.
Unlamented 19th century. And it's always some thousand page tome that he has to review for 30 quid. And, his wife still calculates the following two book reviews a month short.
There's a brilliant line about a paragraph review of a 1,000-page novel, which had to be in by 4 o'clock.
Yeah. And
he works for a vanity publisher.
Yeah.
Tantalus Press.
And he's also the literary editor of something called
The Little Review.
No one has any idea how literal it really
is. That's it's when he's in America, that's the line, isn't it? The Americans would have no idea of just how little The Little Review
magazine
was.
Finally, we should say that Richard Tull is the author of 6 novels, only 3 of them published.
Yeah.
The first one is called A Forethought. Yeah. The second one is
one
called
word.
Dreams Don't Mean Anything.
Yeah.
And the sixth one is called Untitled.
He also goes through saying he knows his failures in all this. He says, after Untitled, he knows there are prospective novels stacked in his drawers called Unfinished, Unattempted, and Unimagined. It's so cruel on Richard's, hope to ambition.
The thing is, Richard is just a spectacularly awful character. I mean, He's just so...
I'm kind of sympathetic to Rachel.
But you can't. That's the genius of Amos, is he makes you sympathetic for this man who is plotting violence, serious violence against his best friend.
But he has no redeeming features. He hits his small child.
But provoked by Gwen Barry, I think you'll find.
Nine in the bestseller list, because that's the thing.
Yeah, that's what triggers it.
Because Gwen Barry is a pathetic, fat Welsh wimp.
Gwen was his university friend, who he'd always
lauded it over, and who was always and had a what she called the girlfriend Gilda, the girlfriend who I love this. There's so many great details. How he used to steal buns for her when he smuggled into her room at college, and she liked marmalade. That's what she got. What happens is he becomes a hugely
gigantically successful.
In a kind of Paolo Coelho kind of, you know, alchemist kind of way. The books are the book. What's the first one called? Summertown, which is.
Do you know what I was thinking about this when I was on the way up here? I was thinking I can think of.
Oh yeah,
contemporary examples. I'm not sure I want to say.
He writes what Richard described as tricks.
Pure tricks. And it comes up, that's one of the things that comes up. Pure tricks, which for listeners who are of a certain generation, tricks was commercially. Through 60s and 70s was large.
So large, yeah.
So you don't think you can buy Trex anymore.
To me, it's an amalgam of text and dreck. He's just this a worthless kind of garbage.
It's a great word.
That means nothing. But by some fluke of publishing and public taste, it's enormous. So Gwen's had this colossal success and lives in a gigantic house and sort of
with servants
in Notting Hill, whereas Rich is in a tiny apartment with a wife and two kids and his failing at everything he does, and his hatred for Gwen just...
Richard had to see whether the experience of disappointment was going to make him bitter or better, and it made him bitter. He was sorry, there was nothing he could do about it. He wasn't up to better. Richard continued to review books. He was very good at book reviewing, and when he reviewed a book, he stayed reviewed. Otherwise, he was an ex-novelist, or not ex so much as void. Or Phantom, the literary editor of the Little magazine and a special director of the Tantalus Press. Now, I have to say, in 1995, I found that terribly amusing.
Yeah.
I find it funny now for a slightly different reason. You know?
Yeah, life. It's a way of catching people up, doesn't it? The thing with Gwen is, I love the way it starts off, as you sort of mentioned in the intro, that the torments he tries to inflict on Gwen are initially quite petty, aren't they? For instance, he sends him a copy of the entire weekend edition of the Los Angeles Times, which is like just a suitcase-sized piece of newsprint with a little post-it on it saying, something to interest you here.
From John, with
no page reference, knowing that Gwen's ego is so ravaged. He'll spend the entire weekend combing every single page.
Which he does.
However, Richard suddenly suspects, what if there is a reference to that? So Richard ends up going through the entire thing himself, cutting his fingers to pieces and having to then repackage it all pristinely. And then Gwen, of course, finds the reference to himself, which there is one in there that Richard's missed.
So he has to then go back again.
He goes to Gwen's house that's lying that's on the side and he says, you're reading the LED. He goes, a reference to me in it.
But it's a copy of his first novel for sale, second-hand copy for sale. It's brilliant.
That's right. It's in the small ads. That's correct. That's right.
We should also add that Richard Tull is also, in theory, working on a non-fiction book called The History of Increasing Humiliation, which becomes a running gag as well.
And of course, his own, Richard's current novel, Dreams Don't Mean Anything, that he's trying to promote, is a book that's so crazily postmodern and terrible and difficultly impossible narrative actually inflicts illness on
everybody who reads it. Untitled, sort of. Nobody can get through. But it's at page 9. Another one. Another one comes down with some terrible disease, and he realizes at one point all he really needed to do was to get Gwen Barry to read his own novel, and he'd have given him a brain tumor, and that would have been it. But I mean, the comedy in Amos is jet black.
There's a brilliant line here, the comedy line. There's a line where they play tennis a lot, right? Richard and Gwen.
And snooker,
right?
At the Warlock.
Said Richard pensively, well, we know one thing. What's that? You're not going to get a profundity requital. The profundity requital is an enormous American stipend.
It looms large in the second half of the book.
Gwen, who was wrong, flexed his forehead and said,
a million people can't be wrong. Richard, who was also wrong, said, a million people are always wrong. Let's play.
So, and that's condensed into just a couple of lines in the middle of this chapter.
It's very good. I mean, there's three or four comic set pieces in the novel that are just that stay with me always. I wanted to read a tiny bit, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Which comes quite early in the book when Richard is taken to a lunch at which there are various publishing luminaries, and he's under the impression that Gwyn's doing him a favour, that he's being considered for the editorship of a new magazine. And this is very funny, but it also makes a fantastic point about literature that I'm an enormous fan of. So that they're lunching in some sort of swank Mayfair restaurant. The financier spoke about the kind of literary magazine he would like to be associated with, the kind of magazine he was prepared to be the financier of. Not so much like Magazine A, not so much like Magazine B, more like Magazine C, defunct, or Magazine D, published in New York. Quinn Barry was then asked about the kind of magazine he would like to be associated with, the kind of magazine that had high standards. Ditto the Captain of Industry, the Shadow Minister for Arts, the female columnist and the male columnist. Rory Plantagenet, the reporter, was not consulted. Neither was the photographer, who was leaving anyway. Neither, depressingly, was Richard Tull, who was struggling to remain under the impression that he was being groomed for the editorship. The only questions that came his way were about technical matters, print runs, break-even junctures and the like. Would there be any point, the financier Sebi was saying, in doing any market research stuff? Richard said, what, reader profile stuff? He had no idea what to say. Age and sex, things like that. I thought we might press a questionnaire on, say, students reading English at London, something of that kind, to see if they like high standards, Richard said. Targeting, said the male columnist, who was about 28 and experimentally bearded, with a school dinner look about him. The column the male columnist wrote was sociopolitical. Come on, Richard said, this isn't America, where the magazine market is completely balkanised, where, you know, they have magazines for the twice-divorced South Moluccan scuba diver. Still, there are more predictable preferences, said the publisher. Women's magazines are read by women, and men... There was a silence. To fill it, Richard said, has anyone ever really established whether men prefer to read men and whether women prefer to read women? Oh, please, what is this, said the female columnist. We're not talking about motorbikes or knitting patterns. We're talking about literature, for God's sake. Richard said, is this without interest? Nabokov said he was frankly homosexual in his literary taste. I don't think men and women read or write in exactly the same way. They go at it differently. And I suppose, the woman said, that there are racial differences too. Richard didn't answer. For a moment, he looked worryingly short-necked. He was, in fact, coping with the digestive matter. Or at least he was sitting tight until the digestive matter resolved itself one with the other. I can't believe I'm hearing this, the woman said. I thought we came here today to talk about art. What's the matter with you? Are you drunk? Richard turned his senses on her. The woman, gruff, sizeable, stalely handsome, and always barging through to her share of the truth. Richard knew the type because literature knew the type, like the smug boiler in the Pritchett story, the Labour politician up north, proud of her brusqueness and her good big bum. The column the female columnist wrote wasn't specifically about being a woman, but the photograph above it somehow needed to have long hair and makeup for it all to hang together. The Shadow Minister for the Arts said, isn't this what literature's meant to be about, transcending human difference? Hear, hear, said the female columnist. Me, I don't give a damn whether people are male, female, black, white, pink, puce or polka-dotted. And that's why you're no good, Richard said. Steady there, said Sebi, the financier. Then he added, as if the very appellation refreshed him, Gwyn. Everyone turned to him in silence. Gwyn was staring at his coffee spoon with a fascinated frown. This is something Gwyn started doing to Richard's insane irritation. He's looking at an orange or a spoon as if he's seeing it for the first time. He thinks it's a novelistic thing to do. Gwyn replaced the spoon in its saucer and looked up, his face clearing, his green eyes brightening. Gwyn said very slowly, I find I never think in terms of men, in terms of women. I always think in terms of people. There was an immediate burble of approbation. Gwyn, it seemed, had douched the entire company in common sense and plain humanity. Richard had to raise his voice, which meant that his cough kicked in, but he went ahead with his passionate speech. It was that little rapt pause before the word people. That was what did it. A very low-level remark, if I may say so. Hey, Gwen, you know what you remind me of? A quiz in a colour magazine, you know. Are you cut out to be a teacher? Would you rather teach A, history, B, geography, or C, children? Well, you don't get a choice about teaching children, but there is a choice and a difference between history and geography. It must make you feel nice and young to say that being a man means nothing and being a woman means nothing, and what matters is being a person. How about being a spider, Gwen? Let's imagine you're a spider. You're a spider and you've just had your first serious date and you're limping away from that now. You're looking over your shoulder and there's your girlfriend eating one of your legs like it was a chicken drumstick. What would you say? I know, you'd say, I find I never think in terms of male spiders or in terms of female spiders. I always think in terms of spiders.
Oh, bravo, brilliant.
Come on, you have to say, utter genius. On form, I mean, there is probably no, I don't think there is a better comic writer in English, so on form.
That's a very Amis thing to do in one of his books as well, is to set up these opposing figures, right? Like, and in this book, it's Richard Tull and Gwyn Barry. And I was thinking about this, and I think the brilliance of this, reading it again, is that it's not really a battle between an unsuccessful author and a successful one. Mm. You know, although it is that. Mm. But it's that most authors think of themselves as Richard Tull and all other authors as Gwyn Barry.
Probably a bit of that's very true. I think what's getting attacked there really, though, is the notion of PC. This idea of, you know, we're all the same and everybody's, you know. Yeah. And that doesn't really fly in literature, because literature is about examining, exploring difference. This is what kind of Richard's rightly saying. And the idea of, I think Amy said in the interview at the time, the very admirable notion of political correctness is to press a sort of accelerator pedal and have us in a future where there's no racism and no sexism and no misogyny. All these things are in the past. However, it takes generations to get there, and the idea to get that you can suddenly hit a button by outlawing certain language. I mean, later on, Richard refers to a woman as reeking of spinst.
And Gwen spinst,
says, you can't say things like that. And he says, why can't I say things like that? And Gwen says, because people will start avoiding you. You know? So Richard's kind of filter is certainly off a lot of the time.
I loved coming back reading it and found it very painful, very funny. But I also found that there were bits of it that, you know, I think the Steve Cousins subplot much less good than I remember it, maybe just because
he'd done it as well. I remember really thinking that at the time, and looking at it again now, Amis has played that character
sort of Keith
in
Talent
previous novels and several times, right?
It doesn't dent the book for me, but I know what you're saying. You feel it's the kind of character that Keith Talent plays in London Fields, sort of, you know.
Because the Richard, Gwen, and the wives, because those, I mean, you don't. It's a big book. It's a 500-page novel, but it's written in Amis's.
I think it's his longest novel.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm interested that you think of the three. It's not having read Money for a long time, and not having read London Fields for even longer. I have to say, I enjoyed this way more than I was. I'd always thought it was the least good of the three, and I think you might be right now. I think. With the benefit of hindsight, and a bit of life under one's belt.
When we knew that John was going to come, that he was to come and talk about the information, and we were going to be reading the information, I was thinking, I haven't read an Amis recently. And I realised I hadn't actually read an Amis since Night Train in 97. Yeah.
I love
Amis. Mm. You know, but So I've read like two or three in the last month just to catch up, really. I read Experience, the memoir, and Cobra the Dread, and the last novel, The Zone of Interest. Mm. They're all terrific. All three of them were terrific. And the thing that struck me about Amis takes a lot of flack. Mm. We know that, right? Mm. You know, some of it may be justified, some of it maybe not. But in the case of all those books, you know, Cobra the Dread was, as a book, problematic in some ways. Experience, terrific memoir, and yet wanders away from the point quite a lot. Zone of Interest, should he be writing another novel about the Holocaust? Is it appropriate? None of them take into account the thing that's really clear in the information as well, which is when it comes to writing brilliant sentences, I can't think of another
contemporary British writer who has quite the same facility with words and language and likes making hard sounds out of words. You know, the bit that you were just reading, John, exactly that, you know.
Yeah.
If you're remotely interested in narrative, you know, how, I mean, the way he puts himself into the text, I mean, he is... You do feel you are in the hands of somebody who can sort of do it. He can do comedy, he can do, you know, he can do diversion into science. He can do. I mean, he is technically, I mean, a pretty spectacular writer. It's, I guess, the thing that people complain about with Amis is that whether you give a shit about any of the characters because he writes.
And also whether he can do working class as well, isn't it? I mean, Lionel Asbo I love his books, but Lionel Asbo is a terrible book.
I thought there were a couple of bits in that that made me bark with laughter.
I think. There was always going to be
Lionel's
funny things.
Explanation of 9/11 is just phrases.
Yeah, but I couldn't read it.
I think what he does is, as a prose stylist, I don't think he has an equal in his generation. And he believes with Nabokov, doesn't he, that style is art, style is morality.
So
to a degree, I don't really care what he's writing about.
I buy that. I mean, I think
there's this brilliant quote from him. You know, when Yellow Dog came out, Yellow Dog, 2003, Yellow Dog
got savage.
Terrible reviews, right? Although it's one of only two of his books that have ever been longlisted for the Booker Prize. Right. Yeah. That and Time's Arrow.
Yeah.
But he got this brilliant quote, this brilliant, in response to why he had received such a drubbing for Yellow Dog. He said, quote, "No one wants to read a difficult literary novel or deal with a prose style which reminds them how thick they are." When faced with the fire, do I reach for the bucket of water or the can of petrol? There's a push towards egalitarianism, making writing more chummy and interactive instead of a higher voice. And that's what I go to literature for.
Yeah.
Right. Ooh. And in terms of, even in Lionel Asbo, you know, it might misfire. He's still trying to find a way of representing that stuff on a higher, linguistic way.
I just think of him in terms of, I mean, I don't mind Lionel Asbo. I prefer Lionel Asbo to any novel by Julian Barnes or Ian McEwan.
Well, that's well said. So I think, when I think of
Martin Amis, I think of those other two novelists. I think of them being part of a generation.
Matthew Clayton's views do not represent those of everyone around the table.
And I just would, you know, I'd far prefer that he be writing something like Lionel Asbo than another Ian McEwan novel appeared.
Yeah, I mean, look, they're all, I think the interesting thing about Amis is they're all, I think all three of those guys are pretty good writers of English.
I have to say I love Barnes.
And I think Barnes is an amazing, as is actually Martin, brilliant essayist.
Yeah.
But there's just something about Amis. I mean, that's a fantastic quote, Andy, by the way. I must scribble that down. Mm. But I mean, I just love that the smallest, it's that thing you feel, there's a brilliant quote in here where he says, he's writing about Richard's Untitled, which all feels a little bit autobiographical. You know, he's saying he was trying to write genius novels like Joyce. Joyce was the best yet at genius novels, which is great. And he was a drag about half the time.
Yeah.
Richard arguably was a drag all the time. If you had to settle on a one-word description of his stuff, then you would almost certainly make do with unreadable. Untitled, for now, remained unread, but no one had ever willingly finished its predecessors. Richard was too proud and too lazy, in a way, too clever and too nuts to write talent novels. For instance, the thought of getting a character out of the house and across town to somewhere else made him go vague with exhaustion. And I sometimes feel this about Amis. It's like, oh my God, it must be so exhausting. You know, every bit of everything that's happening.
But don't you think, John, as well, that
You know what his dad said famously, of course? He said, you know, the thing about Martin's novels, they don't have enough sentences like, they finished their drinks and left.
You know Kingsley's complaint about money?
Yeah, when Martin himself appears in it, he's sent the book flying across the room.
Breaking the rules, buggering about with the reader,
drawing attention to himself.
Don't you think, John, that this very... I mean, this is one of the things that I think people who don't like Amis... either don't like about him or don't get about him. You know, a lot of that stuff about
Richard's awful books and the midlife pain that's in this book as well. Mm-hmm. It seems really autobiographical to me. Mm-hmm, How can you not read it and see that that's coming from...
I think he was uniquely placed to write this, wasn't because he's neither Richard Tull nor Gwyn Barry. He's not a billion-selling sort of punter of treks, and he's not a failure. He's, you know, you could see how he could completely delineate each character brilliantly. He inhabits both the worlds brilliantly. And the point, so just to finish off on that point we were making there about what he thinks the novel is and what literature does. I think it's brilliantly said by Richard in an interview, in a radio interview later in the book. The radio interview is asking, what's your book about? You know, what's it saying? He asks, what's your book trying to say? Yes. He says, it's not trying to say anything. It's saying it. It's saying itself for 400 pages. I couldn't put it any other way. He's not coming to tell you some message or some big story to tell. It's style. It's saying itself. Yeah, in Richard's case, appalling, unreadable style.
Matthew... We've been incredibly relevant so far. Yeah. Is there something you could pull us away from relevance with?
Perhaps. Yeah, actually, it's quite difficult to do a tenuous link for Amos. As you've already suggested, everyone knows every single thing about his life. I know more about Martin Amos than any other novelist, probably. Mm. So but there's one thing you might not know, which is, and it's kind of pertinent to what we've been discussing, which is, do you know, and I'm going to ask you, Andy, do you know what novelist... has a character, a reoccurring character, in fact, called Amos Smallbone.
Ooh.
Amos Small Penis, in other words.
Ooh, is it A.S. Byatt?
I wish it was. It's not, it's Peter James. Yeah, Peter James.
Oh my God.
So Peter James, a crime novelist, and he
Brighton's Peter James.
Amos Smallbone
is a reoccurring gangster with a penis that's described as being like a stubby pencil. Is it? And the reason for this is that Peter James once encountered Martin Amos at the Galaxy Book Awards. And Peter James and Martin Amos had been at the same Oxford Crammar together. Mm-hmm. So Peter James went up to Martin Amos and said...
All right, small penis.
Do you remember me? We're both here. I'm about to get an award. You're about to get an award. Yeah. Do you remember we were at the same Crammar together? And Martin Amos said, I don't remember you. And you only remember me because I'm famous. And then walked away.
I find it hard to believe he said that. He's such a nice man.
It's too neat in a way.
That's very good.
Just quickly... And the second half of the novel, What Love Is, when they go to America for a publicity tour for Gwyn's new novel. And of course, Richard's going to profile him from a Sunday supplement. So there's all constantly funny scenes where Gwyn's travelling first class and Richard's struck right at the back of economy. He gets summoned up to see Gwyn in his crimson barge. He's in a low-rent sort of hotel room and Gwyn's got an entire suite at the, you know, floor at the Excelsior. Yeah, or whatever. Yeah. The humiliation for Richard. Richard's lugging around a Hessian sack with 25 copies of his own novel that he's trying to flip. Just humiliation. It's just, well, and this is all building up towards Gwyn is in line for this thing called the profundity requital, which is basically as a cross, I think, between the Nobel Prize. It involves an enormous cash stipend which the recipient gets every year for life. And so Richard's entire goal, his mission, is to stop Gwyn getting the profundity requital. So it turns out in each city in America they're visiting, there's one of the profundity judges who are known by Gwyn's PR team as Profundity 1, Profundity 2, Profundity 3. They're going to be there. So what Richard's plan is complex and devious. He's arranged for reviews of all these people's books to be published in the Little Magazine. Favourable reviews. And again, they have no idea how little the Little Magazine is, which he then lays on them to show them he's a good bloke and they love him. And he then gains their acquaintance. And he's already found out, for instance, that he's going to be meeting a hugely feminist critic who's one of the judges. So he's basically going to paint Gwyn as to the right of Paul Raymond, or, you know, an absolute sex offender. So he basically is trying to stitch him up with each judge according to the judge's prejudices. So one of the judges he meets in the section where he read is Professor Mills. He's a professor of jurisprudence who's a hugely learned and famously very liberal man, who he gets talking to at a party, and he knows he's one of the friends of himself. Richard goes through the preliminaries of telling himself not to get carried away. So they're talking about the notion of capital punishment. Richard said, "It's amazing how hidebound we are in England. Still, the old ideas, deterrence, sequestration. There's a lot of talk, but no one will bring about any change. Even our most liberal public figures say one thing," and Richard appeared to hesitate, as if considering the etiquette or equity of simply seizing on the nearest example. "Well, take Gwyn Barry. Thoroughly liberal in all his pronouncements, but deep down, you surprise me. In his writing, he seems irreproachably liberal in such matters. Gwyn, oh, you've no idea the kind of things he'll say in private. He actually favours a return to more public forms of punishment." As Mills leans backwards, Richard went through the formality of telling himself not to get carried away. "Yes, with paying spectators, retributive and exemplary, but with a vengeance, so to speak. Stocks and pillories, ceremonial scourgings, ducking stools, tarring and feathering, impalements and flayings. You see, Gwyn thinks the mob has had a poor deal in recent years. Public stonings, even lynchings. You're an Irishman, Professor. You must have followed the case, the bomb in the shopping centre. Here's what Gwyn said. He said, round up all known IRA members and shackle them to the gates of the Tower of London with a big sign, with pictures saying what they did and inviting the public to go ahead and vent their anger. Then, after a couple of months of that, with their arms and their legs and their cocks have all been ripped off, do excuse me, string them up for the ravens. Oh, yes, that's friend Barry for you. They stood side by side, enjoying what Richard felt to be a just and wordless solidarity. However, earlier that winter, the case was still sub judice. Professor Mills had Christmased with his wife at their holiday home in Lake Tackle. Forcing entry on Christmas Eve, a crew of nomad joyriders had then subjected the Millses to a 200-hour ordeal of abuse, battery, bondage and arson. The professor was, of course, aware that a personal experience, however dire, should only carry statistical weight in the settlement of one's intellectual positions. But he was doing a lot of rethinking, which he was going to have to do a lot of anyway, because the many scores of texts he had studied and annotated in preparation for his next book, a lifetime effort provisionally entitled The Lenient Hand, had been mockingly torched by the intruders, along with the rest of his workstation, and it seemed everything else he'd ever cared about. His wife, Marietta, still in deep therapy, hadn't uttered a word since New Year's Day. Because what I mean, the professor has, of course, turned horrifically right wing, and everything Richard says ends up teeing up, giving Gwyn the profundity required, so to speak. But I don't know why I find that quite. The reason I chose it all was rereading it this summer on holiday in Italy, and I was just sort of 6 o'clock, you know, cocktails out, and I was floating in the pool reading the book. And Charlotte, my girlfriend, asked me, she said, "I feared for you. It was just you were laughing so hard, I thought you were going to drown." And it was just, it's the way in the parenthesis of a professionally entitled The Lenient Hand had been mockingly torched. Yeah. It's just such perfectly weighted comic writing.
It did make me think, John, that straight white male in particular feels like it might have kind of come out of some sort of relationship with this book.
I'd say pretty everything I write's in the shadow of Amos, and that novel.
Even though, because there's a great thing that Kennedy wins that prize, the Red Brick University, yeah, which has an element I'd forgotten about the profundity.
Street white male take a lot of the reviews, and as you pointed out earlier, Andy, Martin Amis gets such a hard ride. Some of the reviewers of Minor Street White Male took great delight in saying things like, "This is the best novel Martin Amis hasn't written for years," and it made me angry and embarrassed, actually, because you never think you're fit to stand in the shadow of your predecessor, so you're mad. Ames said that, you know, Nabokov said Joyce's English is my English is patball to Joyce's Champion Game, and I think every writer feels that about the ones they admire. You're not fit to re-ink their printer, if you will.
I read this again basically and thought that this book was really underrated, but including by me. I think that I definitely came off the back
completely,
of it
completely.
But also, I was going to make the comparison, John, that I was trying to think, okay, so this is like 95, this novel comes out in the middle of Britpop, doesn't it?
Right? yeah.
Which Britpop album is this? And I just worked it out. It's Pulp's This Is Hardcore. Which is like a record which has also got terrible reviews when it came out. It's actually terrific. And stands up now really, really well. But it's also like there's something about them both. They're both a bit too long. They're both kind of decadent.
They're quite difficult.
Expensive. Mm-hmm. And they're both chronicles of like despair,
failure,
and failure, and self-loathing. Yeah. And they're both made by people who've come off big hits, about, with things about quote unquote common people.
Oh, Andy, you're on fire! Yeah,
but it's true. No, there is that same very kind good. Of, and then the same thing happens to Pulp for a while, which happens to Amos, which is that they. They burn too bright, they become synonymous with a particular era, and then people want to kind of move away and distance themselves from that era.
That's very well thought out commentary there, and I wish I'd put that kind of pre...
Okay, I wrote it down.
Damn it.
It's very... I mean, what about the thing that always comes up with Amos is that it's a table of men, we're all enjoying it. He doesn't work in the same way for women... I mean, I'm interested in...
Matthew had a point about this.
What the hell was that?
Your girlfriend.
Oh, my wife. So my wife loves... It's literally just my wife loves Martin Amis.
Your girlfriend.
Not my girlfriend, no.
The anecdotal evidence.
Wife also loves Martin Amis.
She read Martin Amis, I think, when she was like 15, 16, 17. And I can see her then reading Martin Amis and absolutely loving it, because it is, for someone who's a kind of, you know... A-level English, slightly rebellious teenager. You know, a teenager with intellectual pretensions. She's never going to listen to
this. You're describing me too, exactly, when I discovered...
That they would read it, and it's something about Martin Amis where he exists in that bit in between sort of high literature and popular fiction, isn't it? And when you're that age, you really... I don't know. I remember reading London Fields when I was young and thinking, God, this is brilliant, you know.
It's the thing that Richard Toll describes in the book, which is... a cult author with a mass audience.
Yeah.
The thing that everybody wants.
But I also think, though, it really... I mean, it's Notting Hill, isn't it? It's Notting Hill. It's Notting Hill I remember when I first moved to London.
Yeah, it didn't sell as well.
A weird mixture of people.
It didn't sell as well as they needed to sell. I seem to remember that it wasn't...
Yeah, but it did okay, sell that quantity of books
now. But then again, the culture was big. It was, you know...
Isn't it the end of Notting Hill? It's like, this is Notting Hill before it becomes Richard Curtis.
This is right at the last moment. I moved to Notting Hill in 1995. The year the novel
came
out. I lived there for 2 years, sort of, when I first started working at London Records. So I just moved from Glasgow, and my friend owned a house, and I was renting a room. And, you know, it was still, you could go down the Portobello Road and that pub, the Warwick Castle, was still an awful cesspit. And it's all gone now. It's long gone. There isn't a single place like that left. Even, I remember the Errol Percy up Ladbroke Grove for a long time was the last bastion of scum.
Yeah.
And even that's now sort of pan-fried trout and fucking frosted Sauvignon gastropub. So, funnily enough, my Charlotte owns a flat in Hackney, and over there it now reminds me credibly of Notting Hill 20 years ago. There's still a lot of rough estates and proper Sky Sports boozers, carpeted floor, England flag up, you know, but surrounded by flat whites and sort of designer, you know, gin palaces. And pretty soon, you know, give it another 10 years, that'll all be gone too, you know, as will everywhere in London be sort of levelled into flat whitedom.
You know, I think Amos is like Welbeck. I think there is a gender split in how people receive what those writers do, but I also think... if you find it funny, then you're probably going to let other stuff go and it won't bother you as much, even if it should bother you, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, and there's this brilliant quote from Amos in Experience. How do the humourless raise children?
Yeah,
how does it get done? How does the stuff get done?
Yeah.
You know. Amos, like with style, is saying style is morality. He also says in Experience, I think this is really central to understanding what he's about. If you don't have that sense of humour, he thinks you're missing an essential intellectual component.
Oh, yeah.
This is criticism of Jeremy Corbyn, which of course made loads of headlines, was he's got no sense of humour. If he doesn't have a sense of humour, how can you expect him to have empathy? Mm. And if he doesn't have empathy, how can you expect him to do all these other things you need him to do?
And I think when you read Amos, he's so bright and his view of the world is so subtle, so complex, so nuanced. The war against cliche, you know, the whole of his sense of himself as a writer is not being able to be boiled down into small sound bites. And there is that extraordinary sense of vertigo inducing, you know, when you're reading an Amos novel.
Just very quickly, I'm glad you mentioned The War Against Cliché. It's a fabulous collection of his criticism. And there's one ace in particular in that, which was his review of Hannibal, the Thomas Harris novel, which he was a huge fan of Red Dragon and Silence of the Lambs. Hannibal, as anyone who's read them all know, completely loses the plot. But at the time it came out, it was hailed as a contender for the Pulitzer. It was hailed as literature. And so Amos brilliantly takes it apart, and he quotes from, I think, a New York Times review that says, you know, this is an absolutely sensational novel. It contains not a single dead or ugly sentence. And Amos says, it's a genre novel, so of course it contains dead and ugly sentences. Unless you feel the breath of life and Tommaso took the lid off the cooler, or Bob Sneed broke the silence.
So as it would say in the information, it's time to stop saying hi
and start saying bye.
He's a pro.
Yeah. John.
That's it for Backlisted this week for another episode. Thanks to John Niven.
Thank you very much for having me, guys. Really,
to Matthew.
Really
enjoyed it. And of course, again, to our sponsors, Unbound. You can get in touch with us on Twitter at BacklistedPod, on Facebook at Backlisted Podcast, and on the Unbound site at unbound.co.uk/backlisted. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with another show in a fortnight.
See you next time, everyone. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Bye. If you prefer to listen to Backlisted without adverts, you can sign up to our Patreon. It's www.patreon.com/backlisted. As well as getting the show early, you get a whole 2 extra episodes of what we call Locklisted, which is Andy, me and Nikki talking about the books, music and films we've enjoyed in the previous fortnight.